This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. In July of 2018, Nikki Collin was in the seventh week of her first season as a head basketball coach at any level. And her team, the WNBA's Atlanta Dream, was not off to a good start.
I think we knew that there was going to be a learning curve. I just don't think that you show up and have 3 weeks of training camp or 2.5 weeks of training camp and figure it all out.
The WNBA regular season is short, just 34 games. And through the first half of 2018, the Dream's record was hovering around 500. Then came Atlanta's home game against the Seattle Storm on July 6th.
Seattle takes this one away. Stewart to Howard.
We just weren't in tune to the game plan. And for the first time all season, I just really felt like we were bad.
Lock off. Seattle will dribble out the remaining time here. And the Dream fall a game under 500 at 8-9.
All of this might have been enough to derail another rookie head coach. But Nikki Collin knows how to be patient. She's had a lot of practice at it.
And we turned around and beat Phoenix in the next game, and it was a big win against a Griner and a Taurasi and some of these giants of our league. And that began an 8-game winning streak, which is the longest in franchise history, and they just got more and more confident.
How exactly did a rookie head coach have the confidence to help her team find their confidence? For that story, we have to go back to the early 80s.
Well,
nice to know she's human, isn't it?
Nikki Collin was in the third grade, and even though she lived in Indiana, her game was tennis. When she wasn't dreaming about becoming an astronaut, she thought she was going to be the next Chris Evert.
I can remember Sunday mornings, like climbing into my parents' bed and watching the French Open. You know, I think that's where I thought my life was headed until we made an abrupt move from Indiana to Wisconsin in the fourth grade.
Nikki's family moved a lot, from Michigan, where she was born, to Ohio, Indiana, and then Wisconsin. Every time the family moved, it was because Nikki's father, who started as an accountant, had moved a little higher up the corporate ladder. The family home in Wisconsin wasn't near any tennis courts, but it did have a concrete driveway with a steel pole hoop. Pretty quickly, Nikki took to dribbling around, just for fun.
You know, I have one of those fathers that, you know, you don't do anything without a plan. And so very quickly it became dribbling around cones so that we could develop the right form and do things the right way. And, you know, I kind of learned the game very fundamentally.
Nikki got good. Really good. When she was in high school, she was recruited to play college ball by a coach named Tom Collin.
I'm assuming we're here to talk about her more than talk about
Absolutely.
Me.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right.
Tom says Nikki was a perfect fit for Purdue University.
You could just see a lot of heart, a refuse to lose kind of attitude all the way back then. And so that's what I fell in love with. And I had no idea that I'd fall in love in a different way somewhere down the road.
But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Tom never got the chance to coach Nikki at Purdue. By the time she arrived, he had moved on to another school. Nikki stayed at Purdue for 2 years before she transferred to Marquette. She says her goal was always to lead the nation in assists. Her junior year, she came in second.
My coach at Marquette used to tell me, she said, you know, I've never understood how someone who spends so much time shooting passes up so many shots. But it was just how I worked, how I played, and kind of my personality as a basketball player.
After college, Nikki played 1 year in Greece, but she knew she'd never make it to the WNBA as a player. So she moved back in with her parents and started interviewing with companies where she could use her degree in mechanical engineering.
You know, at one place it was like, hey, you are going to be helping with this pizza making machine when it breaks down. And potentially redesigning the parking lot.
Nikki accepted a job with Motorola. She put a hold on an apartment in a high-rise with views of downtown Chicago. She was 23 years old, and she thought she had it all figured out.
And I had a call on my answering machine when I got home. This is Tom Collin. You know, I'm trying to track Nikki down. I heard she might be interested in coaching jobs. you know, I called him back and said, geez, I just took this job in engineering.
Initially, it was like, I'm not really sure I'm interested. I'm ready to move on. I said, but Nikki, I know you love basketball. Just do me this one favor. Just jump on the plane and come out here and visit this place. And I know you'll fall in love with it.
I met the team. It was like I was right back in the middle of something that I loved.
Tom was the head women's basketball coach at Colorado State University. Nikki signed on as his assistant.
She was terrific. She doesn't brag about herself a lot, but, you know, she graduated cum laude engineering, so she was very smart. She was very dedicated. You know, she wanted to learn, wanted to grow, wanted the opportunities. And so we were a good match that way because I was a coach that really wanted to empower my assistant coaches. And she did a lot of scouting, was almost really a defensive coordinator right out of the box.
So take me to the moment when you had to fire her. What went down there?
Okay, well, it was the most difficult thing in my life. I mean, I hired this young lady. I brought her out here. She's excited about being a coach. And now I have to fire her.
During her first year at Colorado State, Nikki and Tom had started dating. They'd fallen in love. Tom had asked Nikki to marry him. She'd said yes. But when Tom told the university athletic director, he said no.
Well, you know, those darn nepotism laws.
My hands were tied, you know, and I just put faith in the fact that somehow this windy road was going to lead us back, you know, to where we wanted to be, and that's working together.
And it did. A year later, after Tom and Nikki were married, the university allowed Tom to hire her back. And when Tom left Colorado State, so did Nikki.
That just kind of was the story. My husband's 21 years older than me. At that point in his career, he was further along.
For much of the next 13 years, Nikki was Tom's assistant.
And sometimes I worked and sometimes I didn't.
As Nikki followed her husband from job to job, doubts would sometimes creep in.
Do people think I'm good at my job, or do they think I got this job because I'm married to the head coach? And that really kind of was always with me because I was never able to kind of go out on my own and just have my own voice.
In 2005, while Tom and Nikki were coaching at Louisville, they decided to start a family. Nikki stepped away from the game. She had twins, a boy and a girl. 2 years later, she was pregnant again, and Tom was offered the head coaching job at Arkansas.
You know, gosh, I moved her when she was 8 months pregnant. And so the timing really wasn't best for her to come back on the floor. But I knew in the back of my mind that for me, this was my last hurrah. I knew Arkansas was my last job. When I spoke to the AD, I made it clear that I wasn't going to make this transition. I wasn't going to take this job if at some point in time, you know, that I couldn't move her back onto my staff.
The university agreed, but when Nikki was ready to get back into coaching, Tom didn't have a job opening. Nikki says she enjoyed her time with her kids, but whenever Arkansas played at home, she couldn't stop herself from shouting instructions at the players from the stands.
Bud Walton Arena, you know, seats 20,000, and even when you put 2,000 in there, you certainly can hear a loud voice. So yeah, I mean, the players all knew that I had opinions.
Tom's teams had reached the NCAA tournament 7 out of the 9 seasons he coached at Colorado State and Louisville. But in Arkansas, he went 4 years without a tournament appearance. Finally, in the summer of 2011, 6 years after Nikki had stepped away from coaching, a job opened up. Tom hired Nikki and put her in charge of the team's defense. The team improved from 86th in the country in scoring defense to 10th. They made the 2012 NCAA tournament and won their first round game. In the second round, Tom and Nikki found themselves falling behind.
Texas A&M, quite frankly, was kicking our butt at the time. And I remember at a timeout, I would always go directly into the huddle and make defensive adjustments. And for the first time, I looked at him and said, what do you think we should do? Do you think we should switch to a zone? And he said, that's what I hired you to do. Go figure it out. And I remember just kind of going, okay, thanks for the help. And turned around and made an adjustment, switched to zone. You know, we had a game-winning shot. You know, it came down to the last play.
Arkansas lost. But as Tom and Nikki went through the handshake line after the game, Gary Blair, the head coach at Texas A&M, congratulated Nikki. He said her switch to zone had befuddled his team.
it's those moments. I don't care what career you have or the work that you do, when you have those defining moments where you make a decision and it works, you know, that just continues to build your confidence that you're thinking right, you're processing right. I'm not always going to get it right, but I'm going to keep working at it.
Nikki knew she had the respect of the players at Arkansas and the fans and administration, too. She even had the respect of opposing coaches.
I still didn't know what the perception was, though, nationally. You know, people that didn't know me, people that didn't see how hard I worked, what were they thinking from the outside?
Despite the success he and Nikki were having in Arkansas, Tom was asked to resign.
I just looked at it as a sign. Okay, this is the moment in time where something good is going to happen for Nikki. I always felt like God was kind of in control of that.
Nikki wasn't so sure. Her sister had just died after a short 3-month battle with cancer. Tom had been diagnosed with prostate cancer. She thought maybe she should take a year off, spend time with her family. So she sat down with the athletic director at Arkansas to try to figure out her next move.
He said, "You just got back in. And, you know, if you can keep pushing forward in this profession, people are going to know how good you are, you know." And he even told me at the time, like, it's not as if I'm going to ask your husband to resign and then hire you to be my next head coach. Well, that's pretty awkward. But he said, "I know that ultimately you're going to be capable of being at this level."
So Nikki and Tom moved again. But this time, it wasn't to the place that was best for Tom's career. It was to the place that was best for Nikki's career. She didn't choose the most prominent team or even the team with the best record. Instead, she decided to go to Fort Myers, Florida, to work under the well-respected head coach at Florida Gulf Coast.
It was a unique opportunity for me to build a relationship, you know, with my own 2 feet and to bring ideas to the table that were very much my own. You know, I think my husband is a very, very good coach. But, you know, I had different ideas about how I would do things.
Meanwhile, Tom settled into his new role at home with the couple's 3 kids.
You know, he's definitely turned into Mr. Mom and knows the schedule and runs the calendar. And he's kind of learned to manage a totally different world.
After a year at Florida Gulf Coast, Nikki left to become an assistant for the WNBA's Connecticut Sun. Tom stayed in Florida with the kids. How has it been for you to sort of switch roles? You know, she had the years at home with the kids. Now you're doing that.
That's pretty deep. We could have an entire interview on that. I think at first, when she was an assistant at Florida Gulf Coast, it was a great sense of relief for me that I didn't have those responsibilities as a head coach anymore. I knew she was working for a great person, a successful program. They won a lot of games. But it was a part-time job for me because she was there. Now, when she jumped the WNBA and was gone for 6 months at a time, you know, my attitude probably changed a little bit. It was a little more difficult for me to be able to manage that. But I did a lot of praying about it, and I realized this is where I'm supposed to be. This is what I need to embrace.
After just 2 years in Connecticut, Nikki found herself talking to a friend about making the move from assistant to head coach.
He called me and he said, "Are you interested in the Atlanta job?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm really interested in the Seattle job," you know, because who doesn't want to coach Breanna Stewart? But yeah, I'm kind of intrigued by that.
Nikki flew to Atlanta for an interview, and the Dream offered her the job that same day. After all those years as an assistant, Nikki finally had the opportunity to make the jump to head coach at the sport's highest level.
You know, it took me a few days, and I remember being asked, like, you know, why I hadn't said yes. And I said, "Well, I'm sitting here and my toes are in the water, but we all know when the water's cold, it's hard to jump in, and you just have to make that plunge." And I think the moment I made that plunge, I knew I was ready because you just wake up the next day and you start planning.
Nikki says most WNBA coaches don't live in market. They stay in temporary housing provided by the team for 6 months out of the year. But Nikki and Tom decided to move the whole family to a suburb of Atlanta so everyone could be there to support Nikki in her new role. But then came that first half of the season, the 8-8 record, that game against Seattle when Nikki felt her team was just bad.
Coming out of the locker room, Nikki Collin really encouraging her team to get into the paint, high percentage looks, share the ball, but just not enough to get it done in the fourth quarter. Seattle is really good.
Seattle, by the way, would go on to win the 2018 championship. But after that game, the Dream went on their franchise record 8-game winning streak. They won 15 of their final 17 games. Nikki was named WNBA Coach of the Month in July and again in August. Nikki says the WNBA season is intense. She barely sees her family for 6 months out of the year. But at almost every home game, Tom and their kids, the twins are now 13, the youngest 11, are in the stands cheering.
They saw me all those years. They saw me as the breadwinner and the dad, which is the typical description of a lot of families. So I think it gives our children a chance to see her through a completely different lens. They always knew that they loved her and that she was a good mother, but now they're seeing her as this successful coach, you know, as this businesswoman, as this leader and mentor.
You know, I love that I was able to be at home for them and have that nurturing relationship and be close to them. And I love that they can see that I can be good at something.
In late August, as her team was preparing for a playoff game against the Washington Mystics, Nikki Collin was named WNBA Coach of the Year. Her reaction was muted.
While I'm proud of the accomplishment, I also like, okay, can we move on? We've got a game.
Tom was a bit more emotional.
I cried. I've always known how good she was going to be once she gave the opportunity, but I always felt like she was kind of stuck in my shadow. And so for her, in her first head coaching experience, to be named the Coach of the Year in the greatest women's basketball league in the world is just an amazing accomplishment. So I was just happy and excited for her.
The Dream lost that playoff series to the Mystics, and Nikki Collin went back to chaperoning her kids' field trips and planning for next year. Nikki says the WNBA offseason is slow, at least compared to the college game. She enjoys having this time to spend with her family, and it's given her time to reflect on her journey.
You know, you see probably more men than women who have that direct stair-step path in their career, not unlike my dad. So maybe it makes me appreciate it more. I'd like to think it does, because it wasn't just this easy, simple, straight line to get where we wanted to go.
The Atlanta Dream began their 2019 season on May 24th. Vegas oddsmakers have given the team the fifth best odds to win it all. February 28th was International Rare Disease Day. It's a day that holds special meaning for LA Dodgers pitcher Rich Hill and his family.
We live for our son Brooks and with his memory on an everyday basis.
That story's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
This podcast is made possible by Samuel Adams. For 34 years, Samuel Adams has made their Boston Lager inefficiently. Sam Adams brews with 100% heirloom Mittelfrüh hops, lagering their beer for over a month. The Boston Beer Company, Boston, Mass. Savor the flavor responsibly.
Welcome to the 21st century.
Do you see Jesus in the burnt toast?
Do you realize that literally there's a bucket of condoms by the exit?
Why is this happening? Why is this happening to me?
We cannot just say stop, I want to get off.
Invisibilia, season 5, out March 8th.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for 3 stories you should know.
I mean, I think we live a bit in the age of anxiety.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's I've read studies on this. I think part of it is a direct product of social media.
Yes.
And I think those players we're talking about, when I meet with them, what strikes me is that they are truly unhappy.
Yeah.
That was NBA Commissioner Adam Silver being interviewed at the MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference last weekend. And that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by ESPN's Ryan Smith and by Michael Lee of The Athletic. Welcome back to both of you.
Good to be here.
Hey, thanks. I'm always glad to be here.
All right, Michael, what does all of this mean?
Well, you know, fame, celebrity, and more money than ever don't necessarily equate to happiness for some of the game's biggest stars. And in the social media age, you know, fans have access to players in a way they never have. And it's had positive and negative effects on these guys. Recently, Kevin Love and DeMar DeRozan both came out about their bouts with depression. And while walking into an arena recently, Kyrie Irving looked at the cameras that were flashing on him and said he can't wait for the day when he doesn't have to deal with that anymore. And Kevin Durant just said that basketball won't fulfill him. And it just seems that we've reached a state for NBA players and probably for society, greater society, where all the work that you put in to be special at your craft, sometimes when you get to the reward, it's not what you expect it to be. And when you're an NBA player and you're scrutinized and you have fans that can criticize and speculate on your future and sort of dehumanize you in some ways, it sort of proves that, you know, the higher up you get, the lonelier you become. So I think these players are sort of dealing with it, even though they're well compensated, better than any other generation of basketball players. But it seems that more money is more problems, the way Biggie told us about 20 years ago.
Well, I'll say this. I separate out a mental health discussion with another very important discussion that kind of got wrapped in two, and this was discussed this week, and that is this. Some of this is the price of engagement. Kyrie Irving is the perfect example. This is Uncle Drew. He made a movie on a character. He has said that back when he was younger, he loved the entertainment side of this. He loved the cameras. And now he doesn't like them. And I think one of the big problems that we're seeing in the NBA is guys want the engagement. They want the adulation. They want the love. But when it turns on them, when people start asking them every day because they don't make the right comments about staying with the team, or like Kyrie Irving started intimating that he might go somewhere else, he becomes the story, and then they don't like it. There needs to be, for some of these guys, I'm not saying it's all their responsibility, but some of it is their responsibility.
You know, I'm not at all surprised that social media is making NBA players sad, because it feels like it's making the rest of us sad, too. Yeah. You know, it doesn't seem to matter if you're a millionaire athlete or a minimum wage person. Social media leaves people to compare their worst days to other people's best days, because nobody shares their worst days on social media. And I think that's just got to be even worse when you are a guy who has worked your entire life to make it to this place, and this place is not as fulfilling as you thought it was going to be. And Ryan, I like that you separate out these two issues, but I also kind of like that this issue does call to the other issue. Like, I love that DeMar DeRozan and Kevin Love have talked about their struggles with anxiety and depression. I love that the league and the Players Union has a mental health awareness program and that they're encouraging players to use it. I just think this is all great, because kids who love sports and kids who love athletes need to know that you're not always going to be happy, and it's not always going to be great, and that's okay.
Yeah, and I just think it does a great job in allowing us to connect with these guys, because, you know, so many times you see them on the court or in the field and you feel like they're superhuman, or that they're, you know, special, and they are. They've done great things in their field, but they also deal with the same stresses, the same anxieties that we all deal with.
Ryan, you're up.
Mine is about Bryce Harper. Now, full disclosure, I'm a Philadelphia Philly fan. Just going to put it out there.
But Bryce, I live Harper, in Philly.
Good man. I knew it. Bryce Harper just recently signed the richest contract in Major League Baseball history, a 13-year, $330 million deal to play for the Philadelphia Phillies. One of the first things he starts talking about is not only how great it's going to be in Philly, but how he's going to help recruit other free agents. And he brings up the name of a guy named Mike Trout. Now, Mike Trout, his contract with Angels is up at the end of the 2020 season. Now, that is a problem. And the reason why is baseball, just like other sports, has anti-tampering rules. And that basically means that players can't go out and publicly recruit other players. The theory behind it is, at least according to the leagues, we don't want players trying to influence the decision of other players. It disrupts the contract rights of the teams that already have them signed. So Major League Baseball started investigating, because obviously the Angels were fuming over this. And even after all that, Bryce Harper, when questioned just the other day, he basically said these words: "If I didn't mean it, I wouldn't have said it." I love this guy. I mean, forget about the Philly part of it. Baseball, as in many sports, have these tampering rules, and they're antiquated. The idea that guys don't talk to other people to tell them to come play with them is ridiculous. But baseball just doesn't want, owners don't want to feel like their assets, the people that work for them that they consider assets, which is another ridiculous thing, are sort of in jeopardy.
Yeah, I think this is sort of the NBAification of the Major League Baseball, which is something that really needs to happen, because in the NBA, guys openly campaign for each other every chance they get. LeBron James basically said it would be amazing to play with Anthony Davis this year and totally disrupted two franchises because of it.
The entire league.
Yeah, I just feel like it's good for baseball in the sense that it has a topic that people want to talk about. I think baseball does itself a disservice because there are so many great players that aren't stars that people don't know. I mean, Mike Trout could walk into a room with a Mike Trout t-shirt, with Mike Trout hat, and Mike Trout sneakers, and people be like, who's that?
Right.
Because no one knows who he is, and he keeps such a low profile. And I think that Major League Baseball should do more to promote its game. And I love tampering because it keeps names out there that people are going to be wanting to discuss.
I'm with you guys. I know why this rule exists. I know the league wants to protect its owners and their investments. But it's really, as you say, kind of dumb. I mean, when Mike Trout saw the remarks, his response was to say that it sounds like Harper's really excited. He's really excited about his team. And he is excited. Bryce Harper is excited to be a Philly. God knows why.
I knew you were going to say that.
He did say he wants to bring a title to D.C.
that was a mistake.
But no, I mean, isn't that what we want from our players? We want them to be excited to be on a team and not just cashing a paycheck.
And for a league that wants excitement and wants marketability, like Michael said, this is what you want. This gets us talking about baseball, and we can't stop talking about it.
Okay, the annual spectacle that is the NFL Combine led SB Nation to ask prospective NFL defensive backs a very important question. Without safety help, in single coverage, which animal would be the hardest to cover? Hamp Cheevers from Boston College said a squirrel. And we're both in Boston, so I can say from my knowledge of squirrels in Boston, they would, in fact, be really hard to cover. Sean Bunting of Central Michigan suggests an elephant. And I have seen elephants in the wild. They are surprisingly fast and really, really big. And all of this makes for a good few laughs. But my goodness, it's March. March. I want to talk about spring training. I want to be getting ready for March Madness. I do not need this level of detail on the NFL Combine. I mean, if this is the only question you have left to ask, maybe it's time to walk away slowly and go somewhere else. So I have a question in two parts. One, is there any way to dial this all back to some sort of level of sanity? And two, without safety help in single coverage, which animal would be the hardest to cover?
Oh, I love it. Okay, can I take two first?
Sure.
It would be a cheetah. Ooh. Although I still feel like I could cover the cheetah. We have to test that. At some point, I'll send you guys a video. But
all right,
first answer is this. I'll play a little bit of devil's advocate first. This whole thing is supposed to be sort of a demeaning, confusing process to see how guys respond under pressure. So that's the idea behind the craziness of the combine and all these tests that half of which don't translate to anything that deals with football. But I think there has to be a better way because so much of this, I think, is demeaning, humiliating, and it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
There are scores of people that have excelled at the combine who have never mounted to a hill of beans on a football field. And vice versa. There's people who've done terrible at the combine who ended up being NFL stars. And guys who didn't even get invited to the combine who ended up being NFL stars, said Julian Edelman. But, you know, the biggest thing is I think the NFL needs to start rethinking some of this and try to find a way to stop with the stuff like the 15-minute questions. We saw a big controversy erupt this week with Kyler Murray, who was interviewed for 15 minutes, and one former GM, Charlie Casserly, said that he's talked to a bunch of people, and they said he did terrible on that. And that affects millions of dollars possibly in his pocket because of that. My final point is, this is a spectacle. It's a spectacle that draws viewers, and as long as it draws viewers, it is here to stay.
Yeah, I agree. And to answer your second question, I'm going to go with a bear, primarily because they're really fast, they're really strong, and they have dangerous claws. And if you want to know how tough a bear is, ask Leonardo DiCaprio. He'll tell you, you don't want to mess with a bear. And to answer your first question, I think that this is sort of what's happening now with leagues trying to become year-round sports. And to keep the dialogue going around your league so that you don't ever lose interest and so you always stay engaged with what's going on. And I think it helps with the ratings. It helps with the fan connection. And I think this is just going to happen with every sport. As eventually, baseball will figure this out, too. Because I think one of the things that happens to baseball is that once the season ends, you just forget about it until spring training. But NFL, NBA, they're starting to figure out that as long as you keep fans talking about your product, the more you build up anticipation for it to actually hit the field, and then you get those booms. And that's why you see these players getting paid these insane sums of money. I get it that, you know, it's probably overkill, but I also understand that this is what the beast you have to deal with now.
Yeah. And I have to admit that even though I hate it and I hate myself for it, I do actually find the combine to be entertaining television.
And who was a kid that ran the 40 time and, like, broke down and cried? And, like,
yeah.
I mean, that's kind of stuff that moves you, because you realize that these guys have been dreaming about this moment. And if you have, you know, a special event, it just pushes you over the edge. You feel like this guy made it, you know, even before the draft. And I think that's the kind of stuff that pulls at people's heartstrings.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Michael Lee of The Athletic and ESPN's Ryan Smith. Thanks to both of you.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Thanks. I'm going to go race a cheetah now.
If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to Only a Game on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. That way, you'll never miss a minute of our show. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, and on the latest episode of How I Built This, how Squarespace founder Anthony Casalena came up with the idea for a better website publishing tool in his college dorm room, and since then, built it into a company valued at $1.7 billion.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, the Grammy-nominated musician who owes his career to the illness that forced him to stop playing basketball. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
We could spend this entire segment talking about the Lakers, but let's start here. On Wednesday night, LeBron James passed Michael Jordan for the fourth spot on the NBA all-time scoring list. He said it, quote, ranks right up there at the top with winning a championship. Which is good, because there is approximately zero chance of LeBron winning another championship this year, right?
Yeah, the Lakers are an amazing cartwheeling, pinwheeling fireworks display of a mess right now. But it does say something about Michael Jordan's status among the people who play the game, that this event was made into a capital E event, even though it really only moves LeBron James into fourth place in the scoring list.
Well, Richard Jefferson and Channing Frye, who both played with LeBron in Cleveland, were asked what they thought of their former teammate's accomplishment.
He was a huge ball hog. He never passed
pass the ball.
Right on.
Why don't you try and pass like the all-time assist leaders? Why don't you try and pass John Stockton instead of John
They're joking, of course, but I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that LeBron is 10th on the career assist list, which is not too shabby.
No, it's not too at all. That's pretty funny, though. Actually, why don't you try to catch John Stockton? Nice, by the way, that Richard Jefferson knows who the all-time assist leader is.
Yes, absolutely.
Because it was never going to be him.
The rumor is that LeBron will be put on a minutes restriction for the rest of the season. I guess that's one way to get around completely defrauding the people who paid big money for those courtside seats.
Yes. When he's 92, he's going to look like he can run through a UPS truck, okay? I don't think we're going to pretend that this has anything to do with his health. No, this is a way to tank without tanking.
Speaking of those courtside seats, one member of the Lakers apparently finds them very comfortable, right?
I'll tell you, I'm going to miss Rajon Rondo. He has got one of the most truly unique minds I've ever encountered in any sport. He sits in the courtside seats because he says they're comfortable and he likes them. At the Staples Center, they're not usually open.
Right.
But the Lakers are such a pinwheeling fireworks display of a mess right now that he's got a chance to go sit in them. I would do it.
What I love about this is that when Rondo was in Boston, I used to call him Mr. Excitement because I so enjoyed watching him play.
Yes.
And apparently he can cause excitement just by sitting.
Just by sitting down, exactly. Sitting next to you and, you know, you hope he doesn't get a $25 beer spilled in his lap or something. But, you know, I have no problem with this.
I love it. The letter 9-year-old Riley Morrison wrote to Steph Curry has turned out to be the gift that keeps on giving. This week, the Curry 6 shoes Riley helped design went on sale right in time for International Women's Day. And if they came in my size, I might buy a pair. How about you?
This is a great story, actually. She designed a sock liner in the inside with all kinds of inspirational semi-hashtags. And I hope Zion Williamson buys a pair, because clearly he's not getting what he needs from the ones he's wearing at Duke. I think having Zion Williamson come back for the NCAA tournament in some Riley Morrison designed shoes would be fabulous.
I've always said that the best way to announce that you're quitting the NFL over its substance abuse policy is to do it while smoking a blunt. Wouldn't you agree, Charlie?
I agree, and so does David Irving, who used to play defensive end for the Cowboys and retired live on social media while smoking dope. And he was suspended indefinitely for violating the league's substance abuse policy. And he just said, to hell with it, I'm walking away. And this is a lot better than that opiate stuff, which I thought was a nice way to go out.
Yeah, I mean, it was an Instagram video, and he did say that the painkillers the teams provide to the players to keep them on the field are actually more dangerous than marijuana.
Yeah. And I didn't know there were such things as Xanax bars.
I had no idea.
I mean, what is that, like a Snickers?
But I do wonder, I mean, given how he chose to give his message, if anyone in charge is going to listen.
No, nobody in charge is going to listen, but he just became an idol to every Cowboys fan between the ages of 19 and 30.
The Alabama fan who poisoned the Auburn oak trees has finished his probation, which means he's now free to explain why he did it. And somehow his explanation doesn't make me feel any better.
No, but it's honest.
It's that.
He wanted Auburn people to hate him as much as he hated them, said Harvey Updike Jr., tree poisoner. But I have been to Toomer's Corner, and I have seen those trees, and I still don't like Harvey Updike Jr. There's no reason to take it out on the trees.
And finally, Charlie, FCS national football champions North Dakota State visited the White House this week, and they became the second championship team treated to the best meal money can buy, right?
Big Macs, Chick-fil-A, bunch of French fries. No Chick-fil-A waffle fries, though, which was a real blunder. And what can we say about this except classy?
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins us each week here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
Late last month, L.A. Dodgers pitcher Rich Hill and his wife Caitlin announced a $575,000 donation to Massachusetts General Hospital. The Hills have started a campaign to raise money for rare disease research. They call it the Field of Genes. Why did they choose rare diseases? Only a Game's Shira Springer has the story.
Who I am? My name is Rich Hill. I grew up in Milton, Mass. I'm married with my wife, Caitlin, our sons, Bryce and Brooks.
This is how Rich Hill begins to introduce himself.
We're currently right now with the Los Angeles Dodgers, so I guess that's my job title, pitcher for the Los Angeles Dodgers.
For much of his career, however, Hill had precious little job security. And in 2015, it didn't seem like he'd have any.
There's a couple points in our career. I say our career because my wife has been there through every step of the way, and it's been an incredible journey. And when we talk about perseverance, it's really just, you know, not trying to be perfect as we're going through this life. Because, you know, when we look back on the journey, it's a mess.
Over 14 years, Hill has played for 8 different major league teams, moving from Chicago to Baltimore to Boston to Cleveland to Anaheim, to New York, to Oakland, to L.A. And there have been many minor league stops in between. When his major league career began with the Cubs in 2005, he was a promising young starter with a wicked curveball. But it wasn't long before control issues and injuries set in. Shoulder surgery in 2009 dramatically altered his future.
You think when you go in for surgery, you come out, okay, I'm fixed. Well, that wasn't really the case. So that's what led to me dropping down and actually throwing sidearm, you know, for those 5 years out of the bullpen.
Hill went from prize starter to journeyman reliever. But the hardest part came with the birth of his son, Brooks, in 2013.
Yeah, so a little tough to talk about, but it was an amazing day going in on Christmas night to the hospital. We were both excited. We had left our son at home with actually my brother, so he was, you know, very excited about seeing his new brother. When he was born, we knew that something, you know, may not be right.
Brooks was born on December 26th. At first glance, he looked normal, but his arms and legs stayed unnaturally contracted, hinting at major health issues.
And as the days and the weeks unfolded, we found out that, you know, he had lissencephaly, which is a smoothness of the brain, and polymicrogyri in the back of his brain, where his neurons didn't completely form to where they should have connected in his brain, and also congenital nephrotic syndrome, where his kidneys were failing when he was born, right, you know, from day one. So that was you know, when we found that out, that was extremely difficult.
Doctors said Brooks needed a kidney transplant, and Hill talked with his wife about what their son's quality of life would be.
He was in so much pain every single day, and with the underlying issues of lissencephaly and the polymicrogyri, knowing that he is going to have an extremely difficult path for, you know, 2 to 5 years of the rest of his life if this kidney transplant was successful. You know, who are we doing this for? Are we doing it for ourselves to hold on to somebody, or are we doing it really in his best interest? When I look back on it, there's no right answer. But for us, we decided to take him home on hospice, and he ended up spending the last 3 days of his life, you know, at our house with us, and it was great.
Rich and his wife tried to help their son Bryce understand what was happening to his baby brother.
It wasn't easy because you're telling, you know, a little kid at 2 years old that, you know, his brother isn't going to be here. You know, he was in the hospital with us, with everything. He you know, all the way through to the end, and he was amazing.
Brooks passed away when he was barely 2 months old. 10 days later, Hill reported to spring training with the Boston Red Sox.
The Boston Red Sox organization was amazing, saying, hey, look, take your time. But, you know, I think my wife and I, we... Life keeps moving forward. It doesn't matter. You know, people die. Daily life continues. But with, you know, a different view on life and understanding of time and how precious life is, we live for our son Brooks and with his memory on an everyday basis.
Hill began the 2014 season with Boston's AAA affiliate Pawtucket. In July, he was traded to Anaheim. Less than 2 weeks later, Hill was released. Unsure of what the future held, he returned home to Boston.
And I just found a brick wall, and I'd throw off the brick wall, and then I'd, you know, or I'd go over to BC High in the parking lot, and they have a off the side of their gym, and I'd just, you know, throw the ball off the wall there and play long toss. Anyway, 2 days goes by, and the Yankees call me back and say, hey, you know, come on back to New York. And, you know, I don't know. So 2 days later, I'm back in the big leagues, you know, facing David Ortiz with, you know, runners on second and third and, you know, after playing catch off the wall the day before. You know, it's crazy when you look back. Those are little things that happened along the way.
Still, when the 2015 season started, Hill found himself with the Syracuse Chiefs, the AAA affiliate of the Washington Nationals. And he decided to opt out of his contract. He thought he might find a spot in the majors with another organization. He didn't. He was no longer a prized young starter. He was a 35-year-old reliever with 2 major surgeries and multiple minor league stints on his resume. Hill knew he was a risky investment, so he made a risky move, deciding to play for an independent league team. Because independent league teams don't have any affiliation with Major League Baseball, they're often a last resort for pro players. And as long as Hill was making that move, he wanted to make one more.
I said, if I'm going to go to independent ball and pitch, I want to get back into starting. because this is my opportunity right now. You know, I felt healthy enough to be able to take that opportunity in Long Island.
And so he entered the colorful world of independent league baseball.
Walking down through the tunnel to get to the dugout, you know, I looked over, I saw a bucket. Well, there's your bathroom. So.
Meanwhile, on the mound, he'll embrace the opportunity the Long Island Ducks offered.
I felt good. I felt strong. I felt healthy. My shoulder felt great for the first time throwing over the top in 6 years. I remember talking to Marty, the pitching coach, one day, and he said, "What are you doing here?" Because, you know, the ball was coming out great out of my hand. And I said, well, I would look at it the same way if I was in the front office. You know, I can't just release a guy to let some guy start for us that hasn't started in 6 years. You know, we have to see something.
Hill made his Ducks debut on August 2nd, 2015, pitching against the Bridgeport Bluefish. The left-hander threw 5 innings of no-hit baseball. In his second start, he struck out 14 batters in 6 innings, tying a franchise record.
And I knew that the way the ball was coming out of my hand, the way the spin for my breaking ball was, you know, presenting itself out of my hand, I knew there was going to be an opportunity to get to the big leagues.
Hill was back in the major leagues by mid-September.
His first start since 2009 for Boston native Rich Hill. As that is in there for strike three.
In 4 starts for the Red Sox, he went 2-1 with a 1.55 ERA and 36 strikeouts. The Red Sox wanted to bring Hill back, but the Oakland Athletics offered him more certainty of starting. Hill signed with the Athletics during the offseason, then landed with the L.A. Dodgers after an August 2016 trade.
Pitcher number 44, Rich Hill.
During the Dodgers' playoff run, Hill earned a win over his first team, the Cubs. And barely 6 weeks later, the Dodgers showed how much they valued the veteran. Hill earned the first long-term, big-money contract of his career. And at the press conference announcing the deal, both his sons came to mind.
I'd like to thank my family who is here today, my wife, Caitlin. Excuse me. Our sons, Bryce and Brooks. You know, this is a great day for us.
But it was about more than his new 3-year, $48 million contract.
I think about our son, you know, and it's always something that for me is, it's extremely emotional. We made the decision to live for Brooks. So, you know, and with our son Bryce and keeping Brooks's memory alive, you know, not only for us and for everyone else, but also for him. So he understands that, you know, he had a brother. He had a brother and he has a brother. I mean, he'll always bring up baby Brooks and he'll mention, you know, he knows that he's in heaven and, you know, if he finds a feather, he always thinks, you know, he says baby Brooks is leaving him little messages and stuff like that. So he may not be with us physically, but, you know, we believe that he's with us every single day.
That story came from Only a Game's Shira Springer. We originally aired it in January of 2017. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Nico Emack and Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.